You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is the latest state to file a lawsuit against the manufacturer of the painkiller OxyContin. We'll talk to Attorney General Josh Call. Right now, it's time for a weekly check-in on news stories from around the state. First, the St. Croix Chippewa tribe in northwestern Wisconsin faces a heavy fine after being accused of improperly spending revenues from its casino operation. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, you've reported that the St. Croix Chippewa tribe has been fined $5.5 million by the National Indian Gaming Commission for these allegations of misuse of gaming revenue. What allegedly is going on with that money?
Well, they did an investigation of their gaming revenues, and they found that at least $1.5 million in gaming revenues were used specifically by a small amount of tribal leaders. And they basically used it to line their own pockets. Some of the allegations that have been made or the violations that have been cited include tribal leaders spending gaming revenues on things like bonuses and travel expenses. One council member used these funds to pay for 8 trips to New Mexico, Las Vegas, and Hawaii. And even there was one case where college tuition was paid. So it looks like things were not being done properly. They were spending this money without sufficient documentation.
And the Indian Gaming Commission apparently says this is a fairly rare occurrence when it comes to Native American casinos.
Yeah, I mean, they say that the way that tribal gaming revenues are regulated, they're regulated very well by tribal, state, and federal agencies. So for this type of instance, they feel that it's pretty rare.
For the tribe itself now, they're out apparently the $1.5 million from misuse and then this $5.5 million fine. Is there a thought about the economic impact that could have?
Yeah, I mean, this type of fine could be very significant to the tribe's bottom line. And the tribe has written to the commission saying that this could be very significant and put them in a precarious financial situation. And the commission's chair, Jonadev Chaudhuri, basically responded, well, you might not be in this situation if you hadn't spent money inappropriately, or that's contributed to the precarious financial situation that they're facing. So they really want to see things addressed in the best way possible. There's a potential for settling this fine and reaching an agreement. So the tribe also has about 30 days to appeal it.
Now, these are fines. Is there talk about potential criminal proceedings here?
It's possible that criminal charges could be filed. I mean, if these accusations prove true and the violations that have been cited really do amount to embezzlement, as it would appear, then some of these tribal council leaders, such as council members and the tribe's chairman, Lewis Taylor, could face charges of embezzlement.
We'll leave it there for now. Danny, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about allegations that Wisconsin's St. Croix Chippewa tribe misused gaming revenue. As of today, the tribe has not responded to a request for comment. Now we head to southeastern Wisconsin, where a student pastor was unexpectedly detained this week by federal immigration authorities and remains in custody in Kenosha. Ricardo Torres is a reporter for the Journal Times in Racine. Ricardo, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, student pastor Betty Rendon was arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement last Sunday. That was a surprise to a lot of people in her parish. What do we know about the circumstances of her arrest?
From people who have talked to her, they say that Betty Rendon was arrested at her home in Illinois. She lives in the Chicagoland area. And the details of the arrest, according to people who have talked to Betty Rendon, have been kind of surprising. It starts with ICE officers originally targeting her daughter, who is a DACA recipient. And apparently when her daughter was taking her 5-year-old daughter to school, who is an American citizen, that is when ICE stopped her and arrested her, well, put her in handcuffs, and then drove the car back to Betty Rendon's house where her daughter and her granddaughter were staying. And that is when they arrested Betty Rendon, her husband, Carlos, and another individual.
And as you mentioned, she lives in Chicago, but she is a student pastor at this Wisconsin church. What have we heard from that church itself and leadership in that evangelical Lutheran denomination?
Right. So she is a student pastor at Emmaus Lutheran Church in Racine, and she's been there for about 3 months or so, helping out with parish activities, preaching and things like that. This parish in particular has had a bit of a rough patch trying to keep pastors for a while. They were without a full-time pastor, and so Betty was stepping in to help them out as she studied to become a pastor herself, an ordained pastor herself. And then she was supposed to preach on Mother's Day. And on Wednesday during the arrest, she sent a text message to a parish staff member that read, "No voy a iglesia, ahí vino a mi casa," which translates to, "I'm not going to church. Ice came to my house."
And I understand there's a prayer vigil held on Wednesday for Rendon, who is still detained at this point. What did you hear at that event?
At the prayer vigil, we heard a recapping of the events. There was about 150 to 170 individuals there. And earlier that morning, Rendon's daughter had gone into ICE offices. She had an order of supervision, and she thought that she was going to be deported. And so some people talked about what that meeting was like, and it turns out ICE canceled that order, allowing her to stay. So there was a little bit of hope. There was a little bit of optimism, at least for Betty's daughter, who the DACA recipient who won a small victory, but there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of just anger and concern in the crowd because they view this as an attack, not just on the immigrant community, but on the religious community.
Ricardo, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. It was great to be here.
That was Ricardo Torres from the Journal-Times in Racine. Lastly, a shooting in Appleton this week took the life of a city firefighter and wounded three others. It's led to an outpouring of support from around the state and nation. Chris Miller is a rapid response reporter for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can you give us, Chris, a brief account of what we know about the tragic circumstances of this shooting on Wednesday?
Right. So information is still being updated here, but what I can tell you now is at about 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, police and paramedics responded downtown here to the area of the transit center and the public library. There they found a 47-year-old man who was arriving on a bus from out of the area. He's believed to be from the Wausau area. The initial report was he was having a medical emergency. When first responders arrived, they helped him, and eventually he walked off the bus toward the library. The situation escalated, and shots ended up being fired. It's still a little unclear how that happened, but we're still waiting on more details from that from police. There were four people injured, including the man that was being treated, who's now been identified as Reuben Houston of Wausau. A police officer, Paul Christensen, I believe, was struck also, but he has been released from the hospital. And a bystander was also hit, and she is recovering from her injuries at a local hospital. At this point, we're just waiting for more information from police to sort of fill in the blanks.
And how is the community reacting and rallying after the death of the Appleton firefighter?
It was pretty incredible yesterday to see the outpouring of support after an incident like this. I think you only have to look at some of the photos that our photographers got and some of the video that we had from the procession through town yesterday and the vigil last night to sort of see the amount of support and the outpouring that the community's had over the last 24 hours or so here. And even on social media, fire departments and police departments from all over the state and elsewhere have been sending messages and notes of support too. So it's pretty incredible to see all the support coming toward the Fox Cities.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks for bringing us up to date on that tragic story.
Okay, I appreciate it.
That was Chris Miller, rapid response reporter for the Appleton Post-Crescent, with us to talk about the reaction to a shooting this week that killed city firefighter Mitchell Lundgaard. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call announced yesterday that the state had filed a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of the opioid painkiller OxyContin. The suit alleges that the company downplayed the potential harm caused by the drug and had engaged in deceptive marketing practices that led to the opioid being overprescribed by doctors. Wisconsin is one of five states, including Iowa, Kansas, Maryland, and West Virginia, to challenge Purdue Pharma in court. Attorney General Call spoke with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poinsot yesterday about the lawsuit.
Attorney General Call, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what does the state's lawsuit allege happened with Purdue Pharma?
So first, I think it's important to talk about the context of the opioid epidemic. What we allege is that the conduct of Purdue Pharma and of Richard Sackler, who is a former president and co-chair of the board of Purdue Pharma, engaged in deceptive marketing practices that both changed the general culture with respect to the prescription of opioids, and in particular was meant to increase sales of OxyContin and other opioids. And the effects of that epidemic, as your listeners know, have just been devastating for Wisconsin and for people around the country. From 2000 to 2017, there are over 7,500 Wisconsinites who lost their lives to an overdose involving opioids. In 2017, there were over 900 opioid overdose deaths. And from 2015 to 2016, the number, the overdose death rate in Wisconsin for drug overdoses increased by 24.5%. And what we allege in the complaint is that this was not inevitable. This was the result, in part, due to conduct by Richard Sackler and Purdue Pharma to undertake a concerted and successful effort to change the public's understanding and increase the use of opioids by misleadingly downplaying the risks and overstating the benefits of those drugs.
And so what do you hope to accomplish with this lawsuit?
First and foremost, it's important that we hold accountable those whose unlawful conduct contributed to the opioid epidemic. I think it's important that we have accountability first and foremost because it's the right thing to do to enforce our laws when they've been broken. But also, I think it's really important that we understand what led to this epidemic, because I think that's going to help us as we work to address it. And it's going to hopefully help us work to prevent a future epidemic. And then another part of this is that Purdue Pharma and Richard Sackler made substantial amounts of money as a result of the sale of opioids. And the consequences of that are being felt in all sorts of areas here in Wisconsin. And recovering from Purdue some of the resources that it has made off of the sale of opioids is really important as we work to expand access to substance abuse treatment and take other actions to remedy some of the harms from the opioid epidemic.
Now, Wisconsin is not the only state to pursue this kind of litigation. Iowa, Kansas, Maryland, and West Virginia, on the same day as Wisconsin did, filed their own lawsuits. Are you working with those other attorneys general to make your suits work together as much as possible?
You're right that there are five states that all filed suit on the same day. It was a bipartisan group of AGs. And one of the reasons that we filed at the same time is to convey the seriousness with which we are taking these cases and our state's responses to the opioid epidemic. Four of those five states named as a defendant at least one member of the Sackler family in the cases that they filed. And more broadly, my predecessor announced that Wisconsin is part of a multi-state investigation into opioid manufacturers. And I've announced that we've also joined a multi-state investigation into opioid distributors. And it's important that we work together across states to the extent that we can, because this is an epidemic that has been national in scale. And having AGs across the country working together to work to address this epidemic and to work to get accountability, I think is going to make us more effective in achieving those goals.
We're talking with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about the lawsuit that was filed on Thursday against Purdue Pharma for what is seen as their contribution to the increasing opioid epidemic. And Attorney General Call, you talked about how the opioid epidemic has impacted Wisconsin, other states as well. Is that in large part why you really prioritized this lawsuit?
I think important that we have accountability for the opioid epidemic. That is one of the factors here. The other is, you know, we've alleged that Purdue engaged in repeated violations of the law. In 2007, the state of Wisconsin entered into a consent judgment with Purdue, but despite stopping engaging in deceptive marketing practices after that consent judgment, we've alleged that Purdue continued with those practices, and the consequences, the harm to Wisconsin that has resulted and the harm to the country that has resulted from the actions of those who contributed to this epidemic, including Purdue and Richard Sackler, have been severe. It was an intentional effort to downplay the risks of addiction and the dangers that go with opioid prescriptions, as well as an effort to inflate the benefits of opioids. And the overall goal here was to change the culture with respect to the prescription of those drugs. The prescription rate for opioids increased dramatically from the mid-90s to up to today. We've been making a bit of progress in reducing the prescription rates, which is a step in the right direction, but we still have a long way to go. But that big change in the culture with respect to the prescription of opioids is in part a result of these misleading statements, misleading marketing efforts by Purdue, is what we've alleged in the complaint.
And Oklahoma settled its lawsuit with Purdue Pharma, and the company paid the state about $270 million as a result. Would you like to see a similar payout from the company for Wisconsin, or are you looking for more impact than that?
You know, one of the options that remains available is if there's a settlement on terms that we believe are in the best interest of the state. That's something we'd certainly consider. But I think it is important that as we approach this case against Purdue Pharma and also the multi-state investigations, you know, we're going to be focused on making sure that we maximize the recovery that the state of Wisconsin gets so that more money can go to fund efforts to address the opioid epidemic. More money can go into things, hopefully, like expanding access to substance abuse treatment, efforts to prevent people from becoming addicted in the first place, and efforts to enforce our laws against anybody who is, for example, distributing heroin or other dangerous narcotics across county lines and across state lines. So, number one, maximizing our recovery is important. But number two, making sure that there is a clear accounting here of what led to this epidemic and that people know what led to the devastation that we've had is really important so that we don't repeat this epidemic and so we can learn from that and hopefully use the knowledge that we've gained to respond as effectively as possible to the epidemic.
And what have you heard from Governor Evers about this lawsuit?
Governor Evers joined us at the press conference announcing this suit. He is, I know, supportive of it. And I know that he's also committed to working to address this epidemic and to ensure that there's accountability.
And as you mentioned, Attorney General Call, this is a bipartisan issue, not just state to state, but even here in Wisconsin. The opioid epidemic has been of great concern to the Republican legislature for several years. What have you heard from GOP leaders on this?
I know that Representative Nygren, who has been a leader on this issue, put out a statement indicating that if companies engaged in conduct that broke the law and contributed to the opioid epidemic, that he was that they should be held accountable. And I think that there is, I'm hopeful that there's going to be broad support for this effort to ensure that there's accountability, because this is not an issue that should be partisan in any way, frankly, as today's or as the filings from five states reflect. A bipartisan group, including Republican AGs in West Virginia and Kansas and Democratic AGs here in Wisconsin, in Maryland, and in Iowa, brought suit because this is an issue that has impacted people across the state and across the country. And we need to keep taking action to make sure that we're addressing it as effectively as we can, and so that we can make a difference in the lives of Wisconsinites.
Do you expect that other states might follow suit and file their own lawsuits in the coming weeks and months?
Many states have now filed suit against Purdue Pharma. I believe that before this group filed, I believe it was four states had named at least one member of the Sackler family, and now that has gone up to, I believe, eight states. But I know that states across the country are committed to getting accountability for the role that Purdue Pharma and others played in creating and exacerbating this epidemic. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we will be able to make progress, and perhaps that there will be settlements in some of these cases. But I also think that states are going to be willing to bring suit if they think that that's the best course. And, you know, we will continue moving forward with our multi-state investigations as well.
And as we wrap up, Attorney General Call, the lawsuit was filed on Thursday. What are the next steps? What should we be watching for?
So the case will proceed in the same way that other cases in state court do. There will at some point be a scheduling order issued in the case, and there will be discovery, and we'll move forward. And from there, you know, our hope is that this case moves forward relatively swiftly, because, you know, we are ready to move forward with it. We believe we've got a very strong case, and, you know, our hope is to resolve it and ultimately to recover funds so that we can help work to address the opioid epidemic.
Well, Attorney General Call, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call talking to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about the state's lawsuit against opioid manufacturer Purdue Pharma. The suit alleges the company downplayed the addictive risks associated with drugs like OxyContin and that Purdue Pharma engaged in deceptive marketing practices. Multiple states have recently passed or are considering bills that would restrict abortion. An Alabama bill signed into law on Tuesday outlawed almost all abortions with a penalty of up to 99 years in prison for doctors who perform the procedure. Mississippi, Ohio, Georgia, and other states have passed laws that ban abortion after the detection of a fetal heartbeat. Here in Wisconsin, most abortions are banned after 20 weeks of pregnancy. This latest round of legislation is bringing intense debates over abortion rights back into the spotlight. But abortion wasn't always the partisan flashpoint that it is today. Our next guest has studied the history of how the issue has been talked about in our society and politics. Carissa Haugeberg is an assistant professor of history at Tulane University. She's the author of the book Women Against Abortion, Inside the Largest Moral Reform Movement of the 20th Century. Carissa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, in this day and age, it's hard to imagine abortion not being a key, maybe the key partisan political flashpoint, but that wasn't always the case. Can you take us back to the time before 1973 in Roe versus Wade and talk about how abortion played out in political conversations?
Absolutely. So the initial wave of state regulation that prohibited abortion, except under very narrow circumstances, for example, if a woman's life or health was imperiled, really came into being in the middle of the 19th century. And it coincided with the organization of physicians into the American Medical Association. And one of the very first topics that they took up was abortion. And one thing that was going on is they were seeking to assert control over obstetrics and gynecology, which historically had been controlled by midwives, or in the 19th century, there were many physicians who were called irregulars. And these were practitioners who had some or limited medical training and certainly were not certified. So again, medicine in the United States in the 19th century was largely the Wild West, largely unregulated. So as physicians in the United States were coming into their own and seeking to wrest control over medical provision, they really put their finger on abortion as the issue that they wanted to regulate. And one thing that was happening in the backdrop was that there was a significant uptick in immigration. And one thing that these physicians identified was that white middle-class women's birth rates were declining at the very moment that Irish and Italian women were immigrating to the United States in significant numbers and having very large families. So these physicians excoriated white middle-class women for seeking birth control and abortion and basically contributing to race suicide. So these physicians approached state legislatures and offered that abortion was murder, so using very familiar rhetoric of religion and morals, but that it was sometimes necessary and that it required a trained, certified, well-educated physician in order to distinguish necessary from unnecessary abortions, so they should be the ones to adjudicate that decision. So again, they very deliberately made themselves kind of the arbiter of these laws to determine when it was medically necessary to do so.
And Carissa, as I understand it, as we got closer to Roe versus Wade in the 20th century, the issue turned around in some ways because of medical doctors. Again, can you talk about how this was still seen as more of a medical issue than anything?
Right. So this is what's absolutely fascinating from a historical perspective. Physicians had been among the key drivers, the initiators of anti-abortion legislation in the 19th century. And by the middle of the 20th century, physicians became the key advocates of liberalizing abortion laws because they were the ones who were treating thousands of women showing up in emergency rooms, suffering the effects of self-induced or botched abortions on the underground market. So by the 1960s, abortion had become a major public health emergency.
Talking to Carissa Hogberg from Tulane University, talking about the history of abortion laws and the politics surrounding them. So after the passage of Roe versus Wade, Carissa, did abortion immediately become a partisan issue, a Republican versus Democrat issue?
So that's interesting. The stakes had begun to become more partisan in the 1960s. When Richard Nixon was running for re-election, he was in a tough battle. And one of his key advisors was Pat Buchanan, a Catholic Republican who had the idea that it might be effective to court traditionally Democratic Catholics into the Republican Party by creating abortion as a partisan issue. So indeed, Nixon, who had pretty traditionally been pretty pro-choice, he permitted the military to offer abortion services, did an about-face. And characterized Governor McGovern as somebody who was pro-choice. And again, this is against the backdrop of the ERA. But the stakes really, really became ratcheted up when Reagan was running for president. So by the late 1970s, the Republican Party added an anti-abortion plank to its official party plank. And over the course of the 1980s, it became a litmus test for people who wanted to get a Republican endorsement or become a judge, for example. But I do want to back up and point out that in the late 1960s, as individual states were liberalizing their abortion laws, at that time, the Republican Party still had many feminists, many pro-choice members. So as individual states decriminalized the procedure, this legislation was just as likely to have been offered by pro-choice Republicans as it was pro-choice Democrats. So the Republican Party was very divided, as was the Democratic Party, which had many Catholics in the 1960s and 1970s. So the lines were not clearly drawn until the 1980s and 90s.
And now we see the lines very clearly drawn. The idea of pro-choice Republicans or pro-life Democrats it doesn't seem likely to happen nowadays. But does public opinion reflect the partisanship we see at the political level and among activists on both sides of the debate?
Not exactly. So pretty consistently, polling data shows that Americans have been fairly evenly split on the question of abortion since 1973. Every once in a while, there's a slight movement. So for example, when violence overtook the anti-abortion movement in the late 1980s, Americans became more supportive of pro-choice policies. But again, these numbers have always hovered around the 50-50 mark. But when people are asked more detailed questions, for example, do you support strict restrictions on abortion? Most Americans oppose those. So most Americans, and even most people in Alabama, oppose the extremely strict laws going into place. But again, this is a larger question about democracy and representative government that's really afoot right now. So the politics of abortion, no, they don't always reflect the rank-and-file American public opinion.
We're talking to Carissa Hageberg right now, assistant professor of history at Tulane University, about how our public and political debates about abortion have changed over time as many states are now passing new restrictions on abortion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the public conversation about abortion change during your lifetime? To what do you attribute this partisan intensity around the issue? Do you think anything gets missed when abortion gets talked about in political circles? Do you view this as a driving issue, the driving issue, when you're casting a vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Carissa Hageberg, assistant history professor at Tulane University, author of Women Against Abortion, Inside the Largest Moral Reform Movement of the 20th Century. You can join in as we talk about changing attitudes toward abortion and the politics of abortion over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen this debate change over your lifetime? Have you seen it become more partisan and polarizing, maybe even within your circle of friends, family members, others you know? Call 800-642-1234. Carissa, before we go to our callers, as we mentioned, more and more states now passing restrictions, some states moving in the other direction now. Why now? Why this flurry of states taking action on their abortion laws?
I think one could argue that we see a very emboldened anti-abortion movement, particularly since Justice Kavanaugh joined the Supreme Court. There is a sense among some anti-abortion activists that this is the time that they can be very straightforward with their fetal protective legislation, and that it's more likely to sustain a challenge than ever before. So again, these laws are designed to be challenged, and it just shows how emboldened anti-abortion activists are in this moment.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Kimberly on the line in Appleton. Kimberly, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kimberly?
I'm not so sure if this is a pro-choice or a pro-life issue. I look at this as a women's rights issue, a woman's right to her own body and a woman's right to be able to choose her own health care and to make decisions for herself. Men get to make their own choices. Men get to make their own choices for their health care and make their own decisions. Women should be able to do the same.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for that call. And Carissa, Kimberly sums up the argument, one of the core arguments, I think, on the pro-choice side of things, that this is an issue of women's autonomy. People arguing for abortion restrictions, their core issue is this is a life morally equivalent to a human. Given those two positions, I mean, is there really a middle ground once you start to stake out those positions?
Right. And this is what makes the issue difficult. I mean, forcing women to continue with pregnancy has historically and in the present does set women up for a range of health issues that men will never face. And this is something that feminists have been articulating since the 1960s, that this is an inherently gendered experience and that women ultimately are the ones who suffer from higher rates of complications from pregnancies, from maternal mortality. And so, again, this has been a key point of feminist thought since before the 1960s, but really took flight in the 1960s, arguing that women will never be able to fully participate as equal economic and social citizens without the right to control their bodily integrity and their bodily autonomy.
Thanks for that call, Kimberly. We're talking to Carissa Hageberg, assistant history professor at Tulane University, looking at the changing shape of abortion politics and the debate in the United States. Back to your calls. Matt is with us in Lodi. Matt, hi.
Hello. I think that some of the changing attitudes towards abortion
are somewhat related and centered around the advancements in medical technology, specifically ultrasound. If you look back at some of the debates during Roe versus Wade, we heard that this is a collection of cells. It's not an actual person. It doesn't look like a person. And now that we've got 4D ultrasound where we can see in very distinct detail what that developing embryo, that developing life looks like at different stages, a lot of people have to reevaluate that what happens during an abortion is ending a life. And at what point do we say that that person or that life or that embryo is developing, and while it resides within the mother, it is a distinct and unique person. Analogous to after the child's born, can we say, I don't want to take care of this child anymore. I didn't ask for this, so therefore I want to kill the child.
Matt, thanks for the call. Chris, have you seen medical technology and these more sophisticated views of a developing embryo, as Matt says, changing attitudes on this issue?
Well, without a doubt, there is a vibrant scholarship on the role of changing technology, and in particular ultrasound, especially on anti-abortion strategies. So, for example, many states now require women to be given the opportunity to look at ultrasound images of the fetus. Often they have to do it 48 hours before they can get the actual abortion. But again, this doesn't exactly go in concert with what we know about the medical history of abortion. So, for example, an abortion is no safer because a woman has viewed that image. There's no evidence to suggest that women are impressionable or unsure of their decision when they make the appointment for an abortion. So, again, by and large, these policies are designed to pressure or shame women into not going through with the decision they've already made when they've called and made that appointment. So again, these laws are not born out of any medical necessity.
Thanks for that call. Carissa, in our last minute or so, abortion became a political issue. Now it seems like it's almost become the political issue in a lot of ways. Do you see it as a dominant issue for many voters and politicians now?
Yes. And one thing, when we think about abortion politics historically, although the partisan nature of the debate has changed over time, one thing that's remained pretty constant is that this debate flares up when we socially have anxieties about gender and women's place in society. And so I think it will be very interesting in 10 or 20 years when historians look back on this period to really think about what anxieties about gender might be expressed in the current flurry of abortion legislation.
Carissa, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Carissa Haugeberg is an assistant professor of history at Tulane University. She joins today for a look at the changing nature of the abortion debate over time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the life of a bartender. It's part of WPR's ongoing series exploring Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol.
In a city with never-ending bar options, Dell's Bar in downtown La Crosse sticks out. It's been open since 1933, and on any given day, you'll find 40-year regulars, college students, and tourists chatting with each other around an oval-shaped bar. One Sunday afternoon, with the Brewers game and jukebox blaring, two bartenders tell me what Dell's is famous for: Oktoberfest, camaraderie, and Bloody Marys.
One thing about the Bloodies is that I enjoy making Bloodies. I also enjoy Bloody statistics.
Break it down.
The one year, though, was 12,736 Bloody Marys.
I love how you know these numbers.
Sarah Viner. I've worked here for 20 years. I started working because I was working construction, and we started to get laid off, and I found bartending on the off season. I started bartending, and I liked it. I liked the socialness aspect of it.
Thank you. What can I get you, ladies?
Can I just have a regular Bloody Mary, please?
You too.
I love Dell's because, for one, it's kind of like a small community where it's got a lot of character, and everyone here's a family. My name is Bree Ruppel. I worked at Dell's Bar for about 7 years, on and off. A lot of people who aren't in the industry think that it's always about the drinks. And really, when I come into it, I'm thinking, like, how can I craft this experience for the customer to be the best experience they've had? Because they come here, yeah, they come here to drink after work, but, you know, they want to have a good time. They want good stories. They want good music. And otherwise, they can just drink at home. Oh, I love this song. I want to play this.
That's one thing I love about being here, and the music and how good it feels when we bartend together and make the freaking customers just get into it and just, you know, dance, sing.
I think one of the most insulting things that anyone has said to me as a bartender is, well, so what's your real job? How is this not a real job?
Job.
Paid great money. I love what I do. I don't wake up dreading to go to work.
Nope.
Never have. You may get the bar occasional burnout, but everybody does. That's normal.
I love working Oktoberfest.
Oktoberfest is crazy anywhere you go in La Crosse that whole weekend.
It's fun, it's fast, it's loud.
The thing is that we have such a tight-knit crew here. I always likened it to going to battle. You know, we're downstairs, like, eating food beforehand. People are listening to music to, like, amp themselves up for the shift, getting ready. And then it's kind of like you're thrown into it. It's nonstop. And then by the end, when we're, like, using a snow shovel to scoop up garbage and cups and everyone has left, we all, like, kind of embrace each other. And it's like, oh, my God, we did it. You know, another year in the books. And that was always one of my favorite parts, you know. Yeah, it's busy, but, oh, it's so worth it. It's so fun.
I made a lot of good friends through here through the years. Besties.
Yeah.
Including Bree.
You know, we hit it off right off the bat. But then just throughout the years of working the same shifts together, you know, without speaking, without deciding the rules, we just came into this symbiotic dance that we have behind the bar. We know exactly when to move to get out of each other's way. I know by looking at your face what you need, and I can grab it for you. Some people finish each other's sentences, and we'll finish each other's drinks, you know, as we're making them.
That story was part of WPR's project, High Tolerance. It's a deep dive into Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we continue our coverage of alcohol in Wisconsin with a look at the penalties for drunk driving in the state. And you can share your thoughts on possible changes to those laws. Wisconsin Republicans are holding their convention this weekend with a look back at their loss of the governor's office and a look ahead at the 2020 presidential elections. Our own Sean Johnson will be there, and he's going to bring us the details from this weekend's convention. Plus, we'll take a look at some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science and technology. All that, plus a look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time.